That was Mother's Ocarina Song. This is from my album, Oquaka Speaks. This is a song my aging mother would play on the piano. Hi, this is Janie Reisner, and welcome to Women's Voices. My guest this evening is Marilyn Howell, author of Honor Thy Daughter, and her poignant account of losing her daughter, Mara, to colon cancer, and is also a harrowing view of the U.S. cancer treatment system. Marilyn was trained as a biologist and earned a doctorate in education from Harvard University. She taught at Brookline High School for 3 decades, during which time she created and developed the first mind-body course in public education. Mara was diagnosed with stage 3 colon cancer at the age of 32, which quickly progressed into stage 4, despite trying every conventional and unconventional medical treatment available. Mara's courage and determination to battle the cancer are inspirational, but the cancer's progression was simply unstoppable, and the strong-willed determination that kept her alive began to prevent her from accepting her impending death and come to peace with it. Marilyn depicts her family's struggle to walk the line between hope and despair, acceptance and denial in the face of mortality. There's one thing, however, that sets Honor Thy Daughter apart from other medical dramas. As the pain and suffering grew and the end drew near, Mara and Marilyn considered their limited options and decided to explore the possibilities of psychedelic psychotherapy to ease Mara's final days, making the story as politically provocative as it is emotionally stunning. Published by the nonprofit Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Study, MAPS, Honor Thy Daughter makes a compelling case against the 40-year ban on research into psychedelic psychotherapy, especially as it relates to end-of-life issues. Howell convincingly argues that chemotherapy drugs are far more toxic than MDMA, LSD, or psilocybin, the unconventional treatments her daughter turned to when there was nowhere else she could turn. There is no question that her psychedelic sessions helped her achieve a more pain-free and more peaceful death, writes her mother. However, this is not a book about politics. Rather, it is first and foremost a harrowing story of how a spirited young woman and her heartbroken mother come face to face with mortality and loss. One of the most important fruits of the 21st century will be the acceptance of the therapeutic use of psychedelics to ease physical and existential pain and to provide a deeper understanding and acceptance of death. Honor Thy Daughter provides a glimpse of this use. This is from Ram Dass, spiritual teacher. Marilyn Howell has been to the dark side of the moon. She doesn't flinch from describing the journey, but she transforms it from a story of unfathomable loss and grief to one of love and hope. A brave and beautiful book. This is from Jean Kilbourne, senior scholar at the Wesley Center for Women and author of Can't Buy My Love. Early LSD studies with advanced stage cancer patients showed that LSD-assisted psychotherapy could alleviate symptoms of anxiety, tension, depression, sleep disturbances, psychological withdrawal, and even severe physical pain. MAPS is currently supporting research into how LSD and MDMA can be helpful in treating end-of-life anxiety. This book highlights how out of touch our medical profession is with the value of psychedelic psychotherapy and how primitive our current political system is, which criminalizes compassionate and spiritual treatments for those among us that need it the most. Good evening, Marilyn, and welcome to Women's Voices.
Thank you. I'm very pleased to be with you.
Well, it's lovely to have you here, and thanks for staying up late, you East Coast person.
Little chocolate-covered espresso bean worked just fine.
Oh, good. My first question is, what part did your mother play in your becoming the woman that you are today?
Well, she certainly loved her children and worked very hard to make sure that my brother and I could have the college education that wasn't available or a possibility for her. And I'm very grateful for that education and what it led to in my life.
Well, it did lead to a lot. Here you are.
Yeah.
Your powerful, poignant, and intimate book of yours and Mara's life is truly a gift to all of us. I wonder if you could read your prologue, which really lets us know where your own experience with psychedelic therapy began.
I'd be happy to do that.
Lovely.
It begins. Mm-hmm. Mom, did you ever do drugs when you were in high school? Mara asked. She was 15, a junior at Brookline High School, well past the peak of adolescent angst. Her chopped hair and bitten fingernails had grown back. She no longer avoided me in the corridors at school, and she had even decided to sign up for the senior science course I taught on the connection between mind and body. I don't think any kids at my high school did drugs back then, I said. I heard stories of kids getting drunk, but the most I ever drank was a sip of my parents' wine. I didn't like the taste. Mara's eyes fixed on mine. What about later? This was a question I'd anticipated, wondering when she would ask, and I was glad it came when she was mature enough to hear the truth. It's a long story, I paused, suddenly a bit unsure of myself, how much to say, where to start. Let me give you a backstory first. Mara raised an eyebrow, but it was clear she was listening. I went on. When I was your age, my chest was actually concave. Lying in a bathtub, I could hold half a cup of water right here. I pointed to the base of my sternum. And my ribs were jacked up like this. I held my hands above my lower ribs to show her how they used to be. I was born that way, with a structural deformity. Mara looked away and folded her arms as if to protect herself. She seemed to know that she was going to learn more than she'd bargained for. Back in the mid-70s, when I was getting interested in body-mind connections, I went to a workshop taught by a psychotherapist who did character analysis, Ron Kurtz. By looking at people, their posture, the way they moved, the tension in their muscles, he could make some very canny deductions about their personalities and emotional histories, even how old they were when they had traumatic experiences. I asked him what he thought of the dent in my chest and my flared ribs. He claimed unequivocally that when I was still a fetus in the womb, my mother didn't want me, and as a response, my chest folded in on itself. Later on, as an infant, I sensed my mother's disapproval whenever I started to cry, and I puffed up my little ribcage to hold back my sobs. Mara looked at me for a long moment as though she might be about to cry herself. Did you believe him? She asked. I didn't know what to think. I never heard anything like this in my training to be a biologist. But he shook me up, and he got me to the next step when he suggested some mind-body methods to open up my chest and heal the hurt. I knew I had to find out more. That's when I started Alexander lessons, took Feldenkrais classes, got Rolfed, and went to all kinds of workshops. It was the first time in my life that I felt like a bad student. My teachers kept telling me I had to relax, to stop trying so hard, but I didn't know how. I was like an Energizer bunny, running around looking for the off switch. After 2 years of trying, the pit in my chest was still there and my ribs hadn't budged. At workshops, I heard some stories about experiences of people who had used psychedelics. In particular, I heard that LSD psychotherapy might lead to a breakthrough. LSD psychotherapy? Now that's a combination I never heard, Mara said. At first, I thought she was being sarcastic, but she didn't move an inch from where she was sitting, curled up with her legs tucked under her. She was waiting for more. Let me give you some context. In the 50s and 60s, a certain group of psychiatrists and psychologists used LSD to help their patients uncover the hidden roots of their problems. I did some research and learned that LSD psychotherapy could be a way to get to the truth when your conscious memory is shut down, and that's usually because of trauma. Were you scared? Yes, I was. It wasn't that I thought I'd go crazy or jump out a window. It was more like the fear I got the first time I jumped off a high diving board. I got very reasonable before I jumped. I looked down and checked it out. and there was water in the pool and a lifeguard on duty, and I'd seen other people go ahead of me. So I let go and made the leap. Since then, I've read much more, and the data is clear. LSD is quite safe in a therapeutic setting. There was a quiet moment. Mara seemed to be taking in the information. I decided to stay quiet and let her ask a question when she was ready. So, she finally said, how did you find your psychedelic lifeguard, and what was it like to jump? Good questions, I said. She was helping me frame my thoughts, like a good partner on a research project. I tracked down a person who was familiar with the procedures for LSD psychotherapy and asked him to act as my therapist in my home. He gave me a therapeutic dose of LSD, and he played music tapes he brought with him. I stretched out on the floor with blankets and pillows and put on a blindfold to keep my intention internal. After that, his job was to stay by my side, keep me safe, and do what I asked. I stopped for a minute and took a sip of water. I didn't want to hurry ahead. I wanted to stay aligned with Mara. Are you ready for what happened? I asked. Yes, I think so, she said. Keep going. About half an hour after I took the drug, I began to wail. It was a sound that I had never come out of my mouth before, a chilling sound like a ghost, a banshee. Later on, I learned to call it a primal scream, but at the time, it was not something I knew about, not at all. I guided my therapist's hand to apply pressure to my rib cage, and I knew exactly what place, what angle, and what pressure I needed. My conscious mind split into two parts, one half of me an observer, and the other a suffering infant. I cried more deeply than I ever had before. The pain went into my heart and my chest, and the crying was the only way to release it. Mara could hear my quavering voice. She reached out and touched my hand. It's okay, Mom. Keep talking. The sound changed from a wail to a long, resonating tone, and for hours I repeated the sound, ah, over and over. My identity dissolved, and there were no boundaries between me and my surroundings. I was the sound. I was love. I was peace. Every emotion I had ever felt seemed insignificant by comparison. That's when I really knew what a mystical experience was. It might sound strange to you, but I understood what it meant to be one with God. It had nothing to do with faith or religion or belief. I had experienced God. I stopped and looked at Mara. Is this okay? Does this make any sense to you? She touched my hand again for just a second. What happened next? I was so tired after the therapy session that I slept for 12 hours. It wasn't until the next day that I realized what had happened to my body. During the hours I was vocalizing, my ribs had flattened, and the pit in my chest had become only half as deep. It was as though the sound of God had come through me to release the infant's grief. After a long pause, Mara asked, was Grandma still alive? Yes. Did you tell her what happened? I did. It wasn't easy. I said that my life was a search for truth. I told her that I knew she loved me, but I just had to know what she felt about me before I was born. She broke down and admitted that she was angry when she found out she was pregnant and that she'd hoped for a miscarriage. The silence was as if the air had been sucked out of the room. I had no idea what Mara was thinking. The late afternoon light that had been spilling through the windows was nearly gone. I got up and turned on a lamp, waiting for Mara to say something. Minutes went by before she spoke. Thanks for being honest with me, Mom. Can we not talk about this anymore? And we didn't. Not for a long, long time.
Yes. It's beautiful.
Well, it's very much the way my daughter and I interacted with each other. And that's a wonderful thing to hold close to me, that we cared and were sensitive to each other and could share those kinds of things.
Absolutely. you were tuned to each other. It's lovely. It's very touching. It's teary, too.
Thank you.
Yes. What was your motivation for writing this really incredible book?
There was more than one motivation. Certainly, the writing was a deeply healing experience for me. It kept me close to her, thinking about her, all that we went through. I didn't want to forget anything. So that was part of it. But I could have done that in a diary for myself. The reason I wanted to write a book that people would read outside my immediate circle was the things that we discovered about psychedelic therapy. It had such a powerful and profound influence at the end of her life and on me when it seems all is lost and you're just completely surrounded by pain and agony, and when there's something beautiful in the midst of all of that, a respite from pain, a time when you can reconnect and feel beauty again, something to be grateful for, something to help you keep going. And I wanted the gift that psychedelic therapy gave us to be something that people knew about. I wanted to help dispel the misinformation and bias that surrounds psychedelics. Mm-hmm. So that certainly was another powerful motivation for writing the book.
It seems like it was very hard from the beginning. Could you tell just a little bit about that beginning, her emergency operation where 3 feet of her colon was removed, and what a shock that must have been?
It certainly was. She had been in pain for many months and was misdiagnosed with irritable bowel syndrome, which is sort of the fallback symptom. And I was looking into parasites from her tropical adventures. I didn't really know. But when she was visiting me in the summer of 2005, she started bleeding. And we went to the emergency room. And she finally got the colonoscopy that she should have had months earlier. They saw that it was cancer, and a surgery was performed rather immediately, and I found out, as you said, that feet of her colon was removed, her spleen was removed, part of her pancreas was removed, and along with 12 lymph nodes that could be removed, the surgeon saw some that he thought might well be cancerous that were too dangerous to remove behind the aorta. So she probably, if they had been able to look at those lymph nodes, she may well have had advanced or stage 4 cancer at that point in time. They call it stage 3 unless they have absolute definitive proof. But when the surgeon told me what he had done over the phone, it felt like a death sentence. Mm-hmm. And it was just a struggle for the next 14 months to, first of all, try and battle with everything that we could to fight that cancer, and then the pain, and then finally at the very end, acceptance.
Mm-hmm. Yes, what a journey. As who was it said, you've been to the dark side of the moon.
Yeah, at both coasts, twice to Brazil, and there was no stone left unturned.
St. John, John of...
John of God
was
the spiritual healer that we had heard many, many things about. And Mara was an adventurer, a world traveler. So it was an opportunity either to find some miraculous healing or at the very least to have an adventure and be surrounded by a wonderful healing community.
In addition to this, though, initially you went through the gold standard?
Oh, yeah. Did the standard chemotherapy protocol, and that had a very low chance of even a remission. Only one-third of advanced cancer patients.
So it seemed to all make her sick.
It made her very sick,
yeah.
As did the second chemotherapy protocol, and the third, and the fourth, each one having a smaller and smaller chance of helping her, and just caused more pain and more agony.
I can't imagine seeing your child in such a state for such a long time and feel so helpless.
It was very difficult, and certainly there were times when I just wanted to go with her.
Yes. Well, I'm going to read about one of those times. You eventually went to a healing center in Chicago.
Uh-huh.
And I thought I'd read a little bit about that, if that's okay.
You certainly can.
Okay. The Green Center, it was called, may, not really its name, may be as good an integrative cancer center can be, I thought, but is it the wrong place at the wrong time for Mara? Here we were, pain increasing, money rapidly vanishing, and no place left to go. Mara did her best to stay with the program. We left the center for our hotel carrying two large bags filled with nutritional supplements. We began to keep a four-day log of everything Mara consumed in order to assess and modify her diet for maximum health. But I gave up on record keeping at the end of the third day. It was all I could do to get Mara to eat anything. Whenever she thought of a food she might be able to keep down, I'd rush to the Whole Foods market a few blocks from the hotel to get it. Often she'd lost her appetite for the food by the time I got back. It was impossible for her to follow the recommendations for diet and supplement. Mara added more fentanyl, I hope that's the right pronunciation, patches to manage the pain, but the higher dosage worsened her nausea, constipation, and hemorrhoids. Her upper arms and chest were beginning to look like a fentanyl patchwork quilt. Percolase was added to her medications for the constipation. The bathroom counter and our bedroom nightstand overflowed with drugs. We couldn't sleep through the night because medications were scheduled every 4 or 6 or 8 hours. I wanted Mara to come back to Boston with me, but it was clear that she was too sick to travel. And how could I tell her? I knew what home had come to mean for Mara. I surrender. I quit. I give up. And as so often had happened before, just when we were at our wits' end, we came across a ray of hope. This time it came during a consultation with the oncologist on Friday. He recommended a procedure known as a celiac plexus nerve block. It's sometimes used for patients with intractable pain from abdominal cancers. The oncologist told us the procedure made a difference for 3 of his former patients, like night and day. In theory, once Mara's pain was under control, she would be able to build strength and tolerate chemotherapy. We were going up on the familiar roller coaster ride. We talked about a future when the tides of pain and nausea no longer inundated Mara's life. Whether it was thanks to renewed optimism or a momentary lucky mix of all the drugs inside of her, the next day we got a break from misery. We strolled on the sandy shore of Lake Michigan and enjoyed the cool breeze and the rhythmic sound of the waves. We stopped at a stationery store to get a birthday card for David, her father. Then Mara spotted a hairdresser through a salon window and made an on-the-spot decision to have him cut her hair. Hidden beneath her lime green baseball cap were the long stringy remains of her once lush wavy mane. An inch or two of thick undergrowth stood up like a crew cut. I don't know how he did it, but with scissors, hair gel, and artistry, he made her look gorgeous. My new look could be the start of a turnaround in my life, Mara remarked. It dazzled me to see her smile. There was no turnaround. The nerve block failed. The doctor suspected that the procedure offered no relief because the cancer had spread to her spine, and he ordered a bone scan. The night in the hospital that followed the bone scan was a living hell. From my cot next to her bed, I watched helplessly as Mara's pain rose. Bouts of explosive diarrhea forced her to stumble between bed and bathroom. Her screams shot through me like molten lava. The nurse had no remedies to offer and was not reassuring. There was some relief the next day, but Mara was at a point where it didn't take much to count as an improvement. Mara was back to the familiar suffering she had before the procedure. The diarrhea subsided, suggesting it had been a side effect of the radioactive substance she drank for the bone scan. The bone scan came back showing no metastasis, and she was asked to consider a second nerve block on her right side. I wasn't surprised when Mara declined. During the 4 days Mara was in the hospital, the only thing that kept me sane was the hour-long walk between the hospital and the hotel. I checked mail, picked up anything Mara requested, and got some exercise, but the most compelling reason for my daily walk was the chance to scream. Most of the route was residential, with only an occasional pedestrian passing by. When I saw someone in the distance, I'd calculate how soon they'd be able to hear me and try to blend my roars with those of passing cars. With some of my tension released, I could return to Mara, composed and present. On Friday, Mara was discharged from the hospital. We took a cab back to the hotel with no idea of what to do next. I was plagued with doubt and worry. What if Mara's pain never got under control? What if Mara died here? What if I got sick from all the stress, too sick to care for her? After 10 days in the hotel with Mara, I needed to go home, teach my students, talk to my friends, and get back to the routines that kept me sane. The veneer of steady resolve was getting harder and harder to maintain. David agreed to take my place with Mara the following week. Mara was becoming more muddled, less able to think straight, and less able to decide what she wanted. Worst of all, she knew it. She needed someone at her side who understood the medical options and had no financial interests in the choices. She needed me at her best. Before now, I couldn't imagine that I would relinquish my patient advocate role, even to David, but I no longer trusted myself and was willing to hand over the reins. The next decision about pain control and treatment would take place on David's watch. He arrived in Chicago on Monday as I was preparing to leave. I spoke with Annie, a dear friend, on the phone shortly after returning home. "I hate my life," I moaned. "Don't say that," she begged. "You're scaring me." I didn't want to upset her, but there was no longer anything I could do to shield my friends from my anguish. I could no longer protect anyone but Mara from my pain, and I had begun to feel that my own death might be a great relief.
Thank you for reading that. Yeah. It would have been harder for me.
I thought it was really important for us to hear how really, really difficult these months were.
Yeah, well, there wasn't much respite, but when there was, it was enormous.
I can imagine just being home was helpful, but eventually Mara was moved to your home.
Yes.
And how many months was she there with you?
She was home, let's see, middle of May, June, July, August, so about 4 months.
Uh-huh. So you were right there then.
And we had a wonderful hospice nurse. Some of the best pain doctors probably in the world are in Boston. So we had wonderful help, but an impossible disease.
And friends came and rose to the occasion.
Indeed. Circled the wagon. In fact, we had so much help that it was very hard for me to establish boundaries, which I eventually had to do, in order to maintain some sense of control and let people know exactly what we needed. And they were wonderful. It's hard to imagine surviving it all without both the hospice care and wonderful friends.
Yes, it sounded like your hospice nurse was very wonderful.
Yes, she was.
And did she come daily?
At times she came daily. It depended on how Mara was doing. But she was there and available to be called at any time. And there were night nurses as well. So she did make some trips to oncology appointments and then for the implantation of what's called an intrathecal pump that pumps medication directly into the cerebrospinal fluid. There was hope that that would make a huge difference, and it made some difference, but then she had to keep going back and forth to a pain clinic to get the dosage increased and the concentration increased. So she had unmanageable pain, and that was when, at 3 months before she died, I called McLean Hospital because I had been told they were going to do a study, an end-of-life study, using MDMA, methylene dioxymethamphetamine, which on the street is known as ecstasy. They were going to see whether in this clinical trial if advanced cancer patients could have their anxiety and depression relieved, and in some cases, at least anecdotally, there was reported that it might relieve pain, and to the extent that the pain is existential, it might have even a greater impact. Unfortunately, that study was not ready to go. The DEA was making the researchers go through more and more hoops. The lead researcher told me it was not going to be ready in time for my daughter. But once I knew that there was something out there in the world that might help alleviate her suffering, I was determined to pursue that. And back in the 70s, after LSD and most other psychedelics had been banned, MDMA was used by probably thousands of psychotherapists because it helped people face their fears with a sense of openness and compassion. It was so effective that when the drug was eventually made illegal because it was misused and used by multiple drug users who would show up in emergency rooms, many of these therapists continue to use the drug underground.
Yes, I'm well aware of that. I'm going to interrupt just one moment and say this is KZYX and Women's Voices, and you're listening to my guest Marilyn Howell, who's written Honor Thy Daughter, and she's recounting her last months with her daughter and eventually using MDMA and a number of other things as well. So this is where it all began then, that your awareness, you decided this is something you could pursue.
Yeah. And fortunately, we did find an incredibly generous, compassionate, and knowledgeable underground therapist who had, provided his time and services and the medications without charge. From the heart. We called it a crime of compassion.
Really? We were talking about you reading another section from the book. Is this a section that he's involved, or shall we just talk about it?
Maybe just talk about it.
Okay.
What we did in the initial sessions was MDMA, which had this incredible impact on her emotionally. It helped to make her more open. She was very resistant to talking about herself. Anything that seemed like end-of-life therapy, she didn't want to have anything to do with. But the underground therapist was very open, treated her like a fellow human being on an adventure. And so her first two sessions, several weeks apart, were with MDMA, and they did provide this wonderful respite and relief, the only time she was free of pain. But she wanted to be cured, and as lovely as these experiences were, she knew that psilocybin and LSD were more likely to give her a mystical experience, and she was hoping to tap into some transcendent source of healing. Of course, she knew that I had had a healing experience decades before, and she wanted a miracle. So she wanted something stronger, something more likely to create that miracle. So we had a session with psilocybin and added marijuana and a session with LSD. And while they each provided her with experiences that were positive and that somewhat alleviated her pain, she didn't get her miracle, And as the very end of her life approached, as she, in the last couple of weeks, knew she was dying, at that point, she wanted MDMA again. And what it provided at the very end of her life was an additional choice that most people with that kind of unmanageable pain don't have. The usual choice is, do you want to be in pain or do you want to be asleep? You know, terminal sedation is an option. But with MDMA, she had the option and opportunity to be alert, at peace, even joyful experiences, 2 days before she died and the day she died.
Before her last session, she saw a doctor, a medical doctor. Yes.
Oh, yes. I'd be happy to read a little bit.
I think that gives a flavor of what resistance there really is
exactly.
In the medical community.
Exactly. And this requires a little bit of background,
mm-hmm.
So you know where she was in this process. This is after she'd had 2 sessions with MDMA and psilocybin, and she wanted to try LSD. She knew that was the most potent. At the same time, she wanted to follow the recommendation of the pain doctor who said, go see the psychiatrist. She thought maybe there would be some new psychiatric medication that could help her. So she already was on one psychedelic, the only one that is a prescription drug, ketamine. It was used extensively during World War II for pain. And oddly enough, when the doctor was about to prescribe it, he asked her permission to give it. And I thought that was a bit odd because she had never been asked about any of the other drugs. She was just told, we're switch you to this. And they never told her the side effects, which would include things like, death, heart attacks, and so on. But she was asked about ketamine because it was a psychedelic and theoretically could cause out-of-body experiences. And her response at that point in time was, out of this body? Bring it on. So this particular scene is at that point in time, and just to so that you know the cast of characters, Joyce is the hospice nurse, Alan is the underground therapist, and this is a month before she died. However much courage Mara had, the waves of illness that washed over her were unrelenting. Diligent exercise didn't make her stronger, an antidepressant didn't make her happier, and Alan was still out of town. Mara began using marijuana more regularly to get some distance from the pain and help her sleep. She joked that I was her mom bong, but without much hilarity, because she felt bad that the smoke I breathed for her benefit made me groggy. In spite of her previous reservations, she started to look forward to her psychiatry appointment. Never one to leave a stone unturned, Mara moved with agility between resources outside and inside the system. She was open to the possibility that a psychiatrist might know a way to reduce her pain. The day before the appointment, we learned that Alan was in Boston and would be able to come the next afternoon for Mara's LSD session. He might not have another opportunity until he returned in September, and Mara didn't want to wait. At the same time, she was interested in a psychiatry-based pain control strategy. She chose both. She'd go to her medical appointment at the pain clinic at noon and have the LSD session when she got home. It didn't seem ideal to me. I had hoped to help Mara use the hours before her LSD therapy to prepare. If she could let go of her expectations for the LSD session, if she could be open to the moment without desires or attachment, I believe she'd be more likely to experience a spiritual transformation. I wanted to play quiet music and read passages aloud from Jon Kabat-Zinn's Wherever You Go, There You Are, a practical guide to the Buddhist practice of mindfulness. I marked passages that emphasized letting go of desires and fully accepting the stream of present moments as they unfold. Had I read and taken to heart those passages before we met the psychiatrist, I might have been more help to Mara, but my own expectations, fears, and resentments accompanied me every time I entered a medical setting. Joyce and I sat beside Mara in a small examining room in the pain clinic to wait for the psychiatrist. She wanted us with her. At 12:10, there was a knock on the door. Dr. Young, a slender man with smooth skin and a serious expression, entered and introduced himself. He had a sprinkling of white hairs, making him seem older than his unlined face made him appear. His attitude was serious. After we completed the introductions, he asked Mara what gave her pleasure and what was hard in her daily life. It seemed like a good start. I enjoy listening to music, visits with friends, stories. Sometimes I play games. Her eyes filled up with tears. But I'm tired of being in bed all the time. I'd like to go upstairs, go for a walk. Every time I stand, my pain shoots way up. Your medication levels are already at the maximum, he said. You shouldn't expect much improvement. But if we could reduce your anxiety, you might be able to walk a bit further and have slightly more pain control. I'd like you to double the dose of your antidepressant. Perhaps disappointed that he had nothing more to offer, Mara launched into a discussion of her illegal drug use. Marijuana has worked better than the antidepressant, she said. It helps me relax and sleep. Dr. Young didn't say anything, so Mara continued. The only time I've been pain-free in the last 2 months is when I had therapy with MDMA. Dr. Young listened with an expression of deep concern. Sensing his judgment, Mara didn't tell him she was about to have an LSD session. Instead, she said, I'm considering LSD psychotherapy. LSD is highly toxic to the nervous system. You could become permanently psychotic, he said. I was seething. How dare he project his fear and ignorance onto Mara? With all the control I could muster, I pointed out that psychosis was an exceedingly rare effect of irresponsible use. Are you familiar with the literature on LSD-assisted psychotherapy, I asked. Do you know that before research was banned, hundreds of papers described by positive results, that its safety record is far better than Mara's prescription drugs? I should have known better than to argue about the potential benefits of LSD with Dr. Young. Just 2 months earlier, an editorial in the British Journal of Psychiatry had pointed out the bias in medical training regarding psychedelics, noting that by 1965, over 2,000 papers had been published describing positive results for over 40,000 patients who took psychedelic drugs with few side effects and a high level of safety. Medical training, however, omits these studies of the therapeutic use of psychedelics and teaches only about acute emergencies and the social problems associated with misuse. Dr. Young's response to my questions took us all by surprise. He jerked his head repetitively in imitation of a psychotic patient banging his head against the wall. When he stopped, he leaned closer to Mara, and his tone became ominous. LSD is far more potent than marijuana or MDMA. It is extremely contraindicated. The fact that you're already taking ketamine makes it even more dangerous. Knowing that it was pointless to argue, I shut up. When neither Mara nor I said anything, Dr. Young looked to Joyce for confirmation of his warning. What do you think? He asked. Mara is a responsible adult capable of making her own decisions, Joyce replied. Having failed to recruit a medical colleague, Dr. Young frowned and turned his attention back to Mara. She listened quietly as he reiterated his dismal point of view and told her to make a follow-up appointment in a month. Dr. Young noted his warnings regarding the dangers of LSD in his status report. He was apparently satisfied that he had persuaded Mara not to take it. According to his assessment of her mental statement, she is alert, she is pleasant, she is cooperative, she has good eye contact, she is intermittently tearful, but she does brighten. She is severely emaciated, but she lies on the stretcher in no apparent distress. She has fluent speech without any abnormal thought disorder. Mood is down. Affect is slightly depressed with decreased range. She has no suicidality, no homicidality, no hallucinations, delusions, obsessions, or phobias. She is not acutely anxious. Insight, judgment, and abstract ability are fair. When we left the clinic, Mara made a few astute remarks. Don't worry, Mom. He didn't scare me, she reassured me. He doesn't know any better. I'll never have to see him again. My assessment of my daughter's insight, judgment, and cognitive ability was very different than Dr. Young's. She understood that it was futile to challenge the psychiatrist, beyond that. She saw him as a young and somewhat inept doctor who meant well. Her attitude going into the appointment was that it couldn't hurt, and she remained unflustered afterwards. She was ready to move on to LSD therapy. Her calm reaction helped me let go of my anger and eased my depression and my anxiety. I don't suppose there's a psychiatric scale for measuring compassion or wisdom, but if there were, that morning, my daughter's would have exceeded mine. So that was our experience with the young psychiatrist.
Beautiful. Yeah. Yes, that's very... Yep. There it is.
Yep. You know, there was really only one doctor that we confided in that was very open and came to see her at her house. But we learned to shut up.
I bet you did. You know, our time is getting away. It's just amazing. Where can your book be found? I know you're on Facebook. I've seen it on Facebook.
One can go to maps.org. It's in their store.
That's M-A-P-S.
M-A-P-S.org. It's in their store. There's also a website, www.honorthydaughteralloneword.wordpress.com. And MAPS has also set one up for Marilyn Howell, or people can just look up Honor Thy Daughter. It is in Amazon on Kindle only. So there are plenty of ways,
to get a
hoping
hold of
that soon it will be in bookstores, but at this point online is the safe way to get it, unless you live in Boston.
I see. If someone were wanting to speak to you, is there a way to do that?
Sure. Actually, I'm the only Marilyn Howell in Brookline. They could actually call me.
I was just thinking there might be someone out there with a kind of a similar experience, you know?
Yep.
Is there anything else in these few minutes that you'd like to share? You know, her death was really beautiful.
I'm going to say about the very last part. Well, our plan at the very end, we didn't know how much longer she would live, but we knew it wouldn't be very long. There were sort of two options. One was to have MDMA days alternated with resting days. And the other option would have been to give her very small doses of MDMA to try to keep the pain under control. But because I was so exhausted, we decided to do every other day, not knowing that she was only going to have two more days to live. So on the day that she did die, I asked her early in the morning, would you like to do MDMA? She said, yes. And I put some under her tongue, but she went right back to sleep. I called Alan, the underground psychotherapist, and he said, give her another dose, which I did. And she still didn't wake up, and I was convinced that this was the end. I called her dad. I said, I think she's never going to wake up again. He came over right away. And then for the next, 8 hours, we sat by her side, read, talked, really acted like we did normally, whether she was asleep or not. And somewhere close to 10 o'clock that night, I just had this impulse. A book that Alan had given me was Laura Huxley's This Timeless Moment, and I just flipped through it. And I came to this chapter that I didn't know at the time was going to be her description of Aldous Huxley's death, her husband, who requested LSD because he wanted to be aware for his passage. And I just began reading it. And the part that I was reading was about the fact that a dying person is often treated like a thing as though they're not there, but often they're very much there, and how important touch and voice is in their passage so that they feel connected and not alone. As I read those words and as her dad stroked her, she, who had been asleep apparently for all these hours, took her hand out from under the covers, put her hand in her father's palm, turned her head, looked at him, had this expression of utter peace and joy, and passed. Mm-hmm. It was her final gift to us, that she knew we were there for her. that we loved her and accepted her passing. So it was an incredibly powerful, I can't imagine any more powerful moment in my life. And it did make me tremendously grateful that we had this medication to make that moment not one of pain and not one of just unconsciousness, but one of joy.
On that moment, we have to say goodbye. Thank you so much.
And thank you for making me so very comfortable doing this. Thank you.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.